Welcome to the Eminent Domain Podcast with your host, Clint Schumacher of Dawson & Saad LLP. This is the discussion forum for the Eminent Domain community. Join us as we seek insight from industry thought leaders and experts. We'll follow the latest news in the Eminent Domain world, cases, projects, laws, and policy through the voices of the people who are shaping how we apply the Fifth Amendment.
Welcome to episode 44 of the Eminent Domain Podcast. I'm thankful you've joined us. I'm your host, Clint Schumacher. This is the Sheltered in Place edition, as I and I suspect many of you are working through how to practice law or your various professions in a new and very different world that we're all now living in. So here's my plan for the show that we have for you today. I have two interviews that were recorded at the Eminent Domain and Land Valuation CLE in Nashville that have not yet been shared with this audience, and they're both excellent. The first is with Philip Hundle. Philip is a shareholder of Wadler, Purchase, Hundle, and Kerlick in South Texas. In fact, in Wharton, Texas, Mr. Hundle represents clients in a variety of industries, including oil field services, banking, real estate investments, family farming and ranching operations, and private individuals. His practice focuses on land litigation, including condemnation and eminent domain cases, as well as other types of real estate cases like partitions and easement and boundary disputes. Philip has also served as a special master to the state district court and is a certified mediator specializing in land disputes. Philip and I discuss projects happening in South Texas, notably a number of large pipeline projects. Now, I'll note that Philip and I's interview was recorded before the price of oil precipitously fell, as it has done over the past several weeks, and we're now seeing a number of pipeline projects in Texas and I'm sure across the country being postponed. In addition to discussing pipeline projects, Philip and I talked about one of my favorite topics, Texas high school mascots. I hope that you'll enjoy our conversation and maybe even find some humor in the midst of what has been a series of very difficult weeks with lots of bad news. The second interview is with Tony DeLapelle with the New Jersey firm of McCurdy, Riskin, Olson, and DeLapelle. Tony is a return visitor to the podcast and is well known to most of our listeners. Tony practices exclusively in the area of eminent domain, condemnation, redevelopment law, and real estate tax appeals, and Tony's an excellent trial lawyer. Tony shares one of his war stories. This one involves a very interesting closing argument he made a few days after watching the musical Hamilton. I think you'll find it both insightful and entertaining. Before we get to those interviews, however, I thought it'd be helpful to share some observations on practicing while sheltered in place. Our firm actually decided to ask our staff to start working from home in the first part of March, so we're completing our third week of working remotely. There's some advantages, but there are also, as I'm sure you're finding out, a number of challenges. I came across a posting by a blogger that I follow who has worked at home for several years, and he had a few helpful hints for those that are new to the work-at-home lifestyle that I thought were worth sharing. He suggests, number one, that you start your mornings with something. He gives the example of going for a walk with his dog to a nearby coffee shop. I think that's a great idea. I often have a few special tasks I like to do in the morning first thing after making a cup of coffee, and I think it helps the day's routine start well. Second, he suggests designating certain areas of your house for work. Also a suggestion that I've taken advantage of, and I suspect for most of us who have been professionals for a while, we may have a separate workspace in our home, having to work there from time to time after hours. Next, he says, and I thought this was a very good suggestion, create weekly events to look forward to. I'm grateful to one of my friends, another lawyer in town that has for many years hosted a poker game at his house on Monday nights, has decided to take that game online. And so he and I and several other lawyers and other professionals meet virtually on Monday night. We see each other via Zoom and play over a virtual poker platform. And it's been a great sense of continued community and some relaxation to get together on Monday night and continue our normal poker game. This particular blogger then makes the fourth suggestion, which is to reward yourself and create certain times during long work days to take a break. And I have found, particularly as I've gotten into this third week of working remotely, that if I don't take some breaks during the day, if I don't walk around, if I don't find some distractions to get away from work for pieces of the day, by the end of the day, I'm very emotionally spent. And then his final suggestion is, even though you're stuck inside for work, you can still communicate with others. Call, text, video chat. He gave the example of his wife's office that has decided to meet weekly while we're all shut in place to just get together over a video format and see each other. I think that's another excellent suggestion. Even though we're shut in place, I think having a sense of community and still having access to the relationships that we've built is very important for our psyche and for our emotional well-being. So I thought those were some excellent suggestions. I'll next share with you that I had my first remote mediation earlier this week and wanted to report on it and my experience with it. We mediated using the video conferencing platform Zoom, which I think many people are now getting used to and exposed to and aware of. And the mediator that we selected had experience doing remote mediations before, which was very helpful. And in fact, he set up separate rooms, which is a functionality that you have in the Zoom environment, where each side could be in their own separate rooms, and he could even set up separate caucus rooms during parts of the day. So, for example, there were times where the lawyers were pulled out, the clients remained in their own individual rooms, and there was yet a third virtual room where just the mediator and the lawyers could get together and visit. After the mediation, I came across an article that was published in Law 360 by Daniel Gary. I don't know Daniel, but he had some excellent suggestions on, as he called it in his article, confronting the challenges of virtual mediation. One of the suggestions he had was to make sure your video and virtual conferencing tools are secure. I was somewhat already familiar with the Zoom platform and was able to talk to the mediator ahead of time, really exchange emails with the mediator ahead of time to understand how some of his settings were going to be configured and how practically he was going to conduct the mediation. But as Mr. Gary suggests in his article, he says it's critical for the mediator to demonstrate that the video and virtual conferencing tools being used by the mediator and parties are secure in order to ensure that the information exchanged during the mediation remains confidential, secure, and protected. And he suggested that lawyers involved in a virtual mediation request that the mediator provide this information ahead of time and demonstrate or have the mediator demonstrate the security during a pre-mediation meeting. I think that was a good suggestion. He next suggests that you clarify with the parties if recording of the mediation is permitted. I didn't really think about that. Zoom, during our mediation, Zoom does have a ability to record sessions that are going on. And you can see creates a recording both of the visual component as well as the audio component. I don't believe our mediation was recorded, but I think that's a good question to ask ahead of time. I'll note that in our mediation, we chose not to have a general session. I think having a general session in a video-only format or remote conferencing format might provide or present some additional challenges and things that you'd want to think through and work through. I mean, part of the value, it seems to me, of a general session is having a face-to-face exchange. And if we're going to have a face-to-face exchange, but it only happens virtually, there may be some things that you would want to consider in how you communicate that otherwise you might not consider if you're in person. Of course, so much of our communication is nonverbal, and some of the nonverbal is lost, even in a video conference. And so you might have to give some additional thought to that. We didn't have that issue in the mediation that I had. Then one of the other, you know, important things that perhaps you take for granted is making sure you have a stable internet connection. At our house, we're presently putting a lot of demand on our internet. I've got three teenage boys who are all in now a virtual learning environment where they're meeting periodically with teachers over Zoom calls. I have a wife that's a fourth grade assistant teacher. She meets periodically with her class over Zoom calls. My teenage boys, as perhaps you might guess, play Xbox, which puts a lot of demand on the video or on the internet. We've been cordless cableless at the house for several years, so all of our TV programming comes over the internet. So there can be times when there's that much demand on your internet bandwidth that your internet connection can be unstable. And sure enough, either two or three times during the day, I was basically kicked out of the call. And so you may want to think through, if you're in a situation where you don't always have stable internet, getting to a place, if you can find one and can get access to one, where you have stable internet, or otherwise making provisions to have stable internet connection during the mediation so that you don't basically lose the virtual room during the day. Then as a final observation to working remotely, we now have a handful of courts in my home state of Texas that have issued orders saying that a remote deposition or proposing that a deposition happening remotely in and of itself is not a valid basis for an objection. Basically saying if a lawyer says they can't appear in person but can't appear remotely, The fact that they can't appear in person is not by itself a basis to object to the deposition going forward. Understand that there are some federal courts that have passed similar orders, and I suspect other states either already have or will soon. You know, I've got some grave reservations about trying to do a deposition remotely. I've never done anything other than a very short deposition by telephone or by other remote means. But I suspect that we may soon find a situation where we have no choice but to either conduct remote depositions or forestall our cases for extended periods of time. In Dallas County, where I live, even just today I'm recording this on April the 3rd, 2020, our county judges have issued an order extending what we call the stay-in-place guidelines, meaning basically everybody's got to stay home unless you're serving an essential business function, through May the 20th. All that to say is I think we're coming upon a time where either cases where we need depositions to progress are going to have to either be put on the back burner for an extended period of time, or we're going to have to figure out how to do remote depositions. There's a number of very good articles coming out about how to conduct depositions remotely. I came across one written by two BakerBots partners, Elliot Williams and David Rabinowitz. And among their suggestions, they said, of course, first of all, you've got to choose a video platform such as Zoom or one of the other platforms to ensure that you, the witness, the defending counsel, the court reporter all have visual communication with each other. The bigger issue, it seems to me, is figuring out how to handle deposition exhibits. There's a application called eDepose, which I've never used, but which I understand allow depositions to be shown remotely to a witness. But then you've got the question about hard copy depositions, and I've seen a few helpful hints on how to handle hard copy depositions in a remote environment. You could send a sealed box to the witness with each deposition exhibit otherwise sealed so that they don't have a preview of the exhibits that you want to use, and you can watch the witness open your sealed envelope in front of them to see the hard copy exhibit for the first time. I, of course, would have an additional question if the witness and the defending counsel were in the same room about there being some communication while the deposition was going on. Of course, they can always communicate at breaks, but while the deposition was going on, we would ordinarily be aware of if we were there in person, but may not be aware of if it was happening remotely. That's a consideration to think through. And then, of course, if you're defending a remote deposition, even if you're not in the same place, or especially if you're not in the same place as your witness, it does seem that you would want a way to communicate with them during the deposition at breaks, and you'd want to make sure that you have a secure line of communication to that witness so that you and your witness could visit as need be about issues that arise during the deposition. And then one of the biggest issues, it seems to me, is that, you know, particularly I'm most familiar with the Zoom platform. On the Zoom platform, it can be very difficult when two people are speaking over each other. And of course, we all know in depositions that happens more than we would probably like it to. But in essence, the platform handles that very poorly. Only one person could be heard at a time. And so you can imagine a situation where a court reporter has a lot of difficulty hearing and accurately transcribing situations when people begin to talk over each other, or there's not breaks in between the questioner and the beginning of the witness's answer. So I think special care would have to be taken to make sure that the sound quality, the ability to have only one person speaking at a time, happens in the remote environment. On the subject of sound quality, you might also consider whether or not, particularly the witness, has a microphone that provides adequate sound quality. And you could imagine a situation where you may have to send along a high-quality USB a video camera or video camera and microphone combination so that the witness can be both adequately seen and adequately heard in a way that permits the deposition to go forward unimpeded. So those are just a few thoughts that you might want to consider as we all try to figure out what this new world looks like as we're trying to keep cases moving while being unable to move around freely and see each other as we're accustomed to doing. I hope that you found some of this helpful. And with that, let's get to our interviews of Philip and Tony.
Joining me at the 2020 ALI Eminent Domain Conference in Nashville is Philip Hundel. Philip is a lawyer from El Campo, Texas, Wharton, Texas, down on the Texas coast. Philip came up and caught me this afternoon, and we got to visit for a little bit. Philip, welcome.
Hey, Clint, great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for coming and joining me. I really appreciate it. Philip, I guess, how many years have you come to this conference?
This is my third year now, and it was, I remember my first conference was in Charleston, really enjoyed it, and went back last year to Palm Springs, and so now we're here in Nashville.
Well, wonderful. Tell us a little bit about your practice.
So I practice at a firm, the name is Wadler, Purchase, Hundle, and Kerlick, and I our firm is about nine attorneys, and I say about because we're plus or minus attorney, it depends. And we cover basically all practice areas. However, my practice area focuses on real estate litigation, which 90% of it is representing landowners facing condemnation, and 10% related to other real estate litigation, partition suits, boundary disputes, things like that.
Wonderful. And we got to visit a little bit this afternoon before the interview and talk a little bit about some of the projects you guys are seeing. But tell us what's coming through your part of the state.
So we're along the Gulf Coast. We're about an hour. Our county, we've got several offices, but our main office is in Wharton County. We have some offices in Fort Bend County and now in Matagorda counties where as well. But where we're located, there's just multiple pipelines, big trunk lines running from essentially the Permian Basin, West Texas. They either go south of San Antonio, as you know, or they go north of San Antonio, and one, namely the Kinder Morgan PHP line, all that's running through the, getting to the coast or working its way to the coast. And so lots of large pipeline projects, be it Kinder Morgan, Enterprise, Epic, you name it, it seems like, well, all pipelines lead to the Gulf Coast. That's what I've heard. So,
and we got to visit a little bit earlier, but there's a tremendous amount of product being produced in the Permian Basin, which is in far west Texas, trying to make its way to the Gulf Coast, and there has been a tremendous amount of pipeline activity in our state. Philip, any interesting issues you've been bouncing up against, legal issues or appraisal issues?
So, I think the several challenges that we are always facing is, it's the initial interaction that the landowners have with the right-of-way agents, and the representations or sometimes misrepresentations by the right-of-way agents, and so that sometimes it seems like the pipeline companies start off on the wrong foot sometimes, unfortunately, with the landowners, and so landowners contact us, and so then we're involved, and I think by trying to educate landowners, number one, on the process and how the condemnation process works is helpful, but I think a big challenge always is really just explaining the process and how land is valued and how the pipeline company will value their land, or the pipeline companies hired appraiser will value their land, and explaining all those concepts, because it's all foreign, and it understandably so is foreign to landowners that haven't faced condemnation before, or even if they've had a pipeline in the past, it hasn't maybe been that recent, and so it's all new to them. I mean, for guys like you and I mean, we do this every day, and so it becomes very commonplace for us, and the terminology we use and the valuations and the formulas and the damage to the remainder discussions and all those things, and it's not to the normal landowner.
Well, that's a very good point, and just kind of highlights the importance of property owners finding legal representation when something as important as a pipeline crossing their property shows up at the door. They're dealing with experienced right-of-way agents who are paid by the pipelines to get product under wraps or to get property under wraps, and it's good to get some professional guidance. Philip, I know one of the things that you told me as we were visiting before is that you always enjoy kind of our cross-examination segment, so I may spring one or two of those on you if you don't mind. One of the questions I like to ask folks is if there's anybody, an actor or actress, that looks like them, and if so, who it is?
Oh, right. Well, as I told you during one of the breaks, I enjoy your podcast. I listen to your podcast all the time. And so I appreciate the work that you do in putting on the podcast. I know it's not easy, but it's very informative for everyone in this practice area. So I encourage, I've actually showed landowners my phone and how to load the podcast on their phone. So hopefully your subscribership is increasing. But so your question to me is if an actor that I think I somewhat look at, and this dates me, most people probably don't know who this person is, but Matthew Modine.
Okay.
I think I somewhat look like him. I've mentioned that to my wife, and she says that I don't look like him, and there is no actor that looks like me. So I guess I have no hope in Hollywood. So,
well, and I have to ask you this. You guys have one of your offices in El Campo, and this has never come up on the podcast before, so this is a new topic. I am somewhat of a Texas high school mascot buff, and El Campo has one of the best mascots in the state. What is the El Campo high school mascot?
Right, you're right. So every year, that never fails, there's always some article, well, an article in some newspaper that talks about the unique mascots around Texas, and El Campo always comes up because they are the Rice Birds, the El Campo Rice Birds. I think the other ones I always see is it's the Hutto Hippos the Duck, Taylor Ducks, and I don't know. So I actually went, and so there's a in Wharton County, there's several schools, but there's a big rivalry between El Campo and Wharton, because one town is on one side of the Colorado River and the other town's on the other, right? And so there's always a big river battle, and I actually graduated from Wharton High School, who are the Tigers, not very unique mascot, but it's always the battle of the river and the river battle, and it's always a lot of fun, and believe me, I always I catch a lot of heck that week during the rivalry week, because I do live in El Campo. So
and is there an explanation as to what a rice bird is? What is a rice bird?
So there's a lot of rice fields around Wharton in Colorado County, and so the birds that are in the rice fields are considered the rice birds. What exactly is a rice bird? That's a very good question that I'm always asked. So I don't know. I think it's a black bird, but the mascot of El Campo High School is a white caricature bird. So it's somewhat like a chupacabra. What is it? So
well, that's excellent. And I had a cousin one year that was the mascot for the Tasca High School Wampus Cats. So she was the Wampus Cat one year.
Oh, that's a new one on me.
That's
okay.
A good one. Well, hey, Philip, I enjoyed getting to visit with you. Thanks for coming by and giving us an interview for the podcast.
Pleasure. Thanks, Clint.
All right, we're at the 2020 Eminent Domain and Land Valuation Litigation Conference. It's Friday morning. I have run into my friend Tony DeLaPelle in the hallway, and he was telling me a story about a trial that he had a couple of years ago, and I said, Tony, that's too good not to share. So, Tony, if you don't mind, tell us about your case, and then I certainly want to hear the punchline that you shared with me out in the hall.
Sure. Clint, thank you so much. It's great to be here with you, and I appreciate you taking the time to share these stories with your audience. My story is not a long one, but about 2 years ago, I tried a case involving a very valuable property on the Hudson River in New Jersey, right across from Midtown Manhattan. And the case lasted through 2 weeks, and my summation was scheduled to take place the beginning of the week on the second Monday of the trial. And in my state, the property owner sums up first, so I was opening act for the summation, and I got in front of the jury. There was no wall between us and the jury, no knee wall. They were just right in the courtroom, so I was inches away from them. And
is this a Monday morning?
Monday morning.
Okay, Monday morning.
I'm inches away from the jury after having spent a week giving them all this boring detail about how land was so valuable in Hudson County, New Jersey, in the city of Hoboken. And I looked at them and decided that I would do something different than what I usually do in my closing. So I started with a story to try to get their attention and make them realize that what they were doing was something that they can all think about in a different way. So I asked them if they had a nice weekend, and I told them that I ended up working over the weekend, but not in the way that they would think, because I had the good fortune of attending a Broadway show with one of my daughters. And I got to see the show Hamilton, and that happened on Saturday. And I told the jury that while I was watching the show, I realized it was about this case. And that opened their eyes. Sure. They couldn't understand why this lawyer was telling, you know, them that a Broadway show had to do with why they were sitting there.
Absolutely.
And I indicated that during the show, for those of the folks on the jury who had not had the benefit of seeing it, there's a very important scene where Alexander Hamilton is in a room and he's writing the Bill of Rights with James Madison and Thomas Jefferson. And Aaron Burr finds out what they're doing and he wants to get into the room. And they won't let him in. And there's a big song in the play about it. It's a pretty well-known song. Very dramatically done. They don't let him in the room. He's angry. His anger stays with him. And eventually, he, because he couldn't get into the room to participate in the writing of the Bill of Rights, he challenged Alexander Hamilton to a duel. And as you know, we all know, Burr won that duel and killed Hamilton. And when I told the jury that the reason why it was so important for those three founding fathers to have excluded Burr from the room, because they were writing the Bill of Rights, including the Fifth Amendment, which is what the case was about, they started to realize about the connection between the case and the play. But then I also asked them to remember that 3 days earlier they had been to the property, because in my state the jury gets to inspect the property usually.
Okay.
And they were walking along this beautiful Hudson Riverfront property looking at New York City. And I asked them to remember when they turned around and had their back to the Hudson River, when they saw the property, the next thing they could see when they looked up the hill was the exact spot where Burr killed Hamilton, because that's where we were.
Oh, wow.
And it was remarkable to me to have thought about this on the Saturday that I was watching a play about a very important set of events in our history. And it was because of those events that we have a Fifth Amendment, and it was because of the Fifth Amendment that those jurors were sitting in that jury box. So that was the way it ended, and we got a very good result, and we were happy. Client was very happy with the result, so the jury paid attention.
What a great connection and great lawyering, and you hope when you pull off some great lawyering, you get a good result. So that's wonderful. Yeah. Did you get to talk to any of the jury members afterwards?
We do not get to do that.
Okay.
Unfortunately, but I will tell you this. I left on my jury. We get eight sitting in the box and six vote in New Jersey.
Okay.
I left a law student on my jury after consultation with the client, which I normally don't want a lawyer on my jury.
Yeah.
But I felt that it was a third-year law student, and she probably was taking courses on constitutional law.
Yeah.
It was winter break. It was January.
Okay.
So she was off from her semester, and the client said, let's leave her on. So we left her on. Fast forward more than a year later, I'm at a bar association event, and there is a lawyer there who worked for the local prosecutor's office. And I started to talk to him because I knew his supervisor, and the three of us were talking. And he said, you know, one of our other colleagues was one of your jurors. And I said, what case? And they said, the case where you talked about Hamilton. And I said, wow, that worked, didn't it? And they said, yeah, you really made an impression on that jury. And the law student said that it really brought everything together. So it was nice to know. So I got indirect feedback.
Well, Tony, thank you for sharing that story. And even more so, thank you for, I know you've been on the podcast before. And listen to it, and I really appreciate that. And it's good to get to see you again here in Nashville.
Great. Having a great time, and keep up the good work.
Thanks, Tony. Take care.
Take care.
Thank you so much for joining us on episode 44 of the Eminent Domain Podcast. I hope that you found something useful and helpful. If you have an idea for a guest or know about a case or issue that should be discussed, please let me know. My contact information is on our website. As always, we'll try to continue to release episodes around the first of the month and middle of the month, and we are honored that you've joined us and hope that you'll continue to do so. Until next time, we leave you with the words of Winston Churchill. All the great things are simple, and many can be expressed in a single word: freedom, justice, honor, duty, mercy, hope. To all of our listeners, we hope that you'll take good care of yourself, stay well, and we look forward to visiting with you soon.
Thank you for joining us on the Eminent Domain Podcast. The materials in this podcast are made available by Dawson & Saad LLP for informational purposes only and do not constitute legal advice. The transmission and receipt of information contained in this product do not form or constitute an attorney-client relationship. The transmission of an email request for information does not create an attorney-client relationship, and you should not send us via email any confidential information or facts relating to your legal problems or questions unless we are first formally engaged as your counsel. Anyone receiving any part of the information in this podcast should not act upon the information without seeking professional legal counsel. Views and opinions of guests of this podcast may not constitute the views and opinions of the host or of Dawson & Sod, LLP.